It's all about the macro productions.
Flashback Fridays here on Macro Aggressions, taking you back to May 20th, 2023, episode 335, The Old World Order with Monica Perez. Start stacking silver automatically each month by becoming a member of the Wolf Pack. Just go to macroaggressions.gold to find out how. Now enjoy the show.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the CS hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macro aggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macro Aggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks so much. We appreciate your amazing support. You can find me on Twitter at macroaggression or go to the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. And if you like this, you can share it with your friends and family. It's pretty easy to do that. Thank you to our sponsors that make this show possible. Legal Shield has been in business for half a century. They're operating in the United States and Canada. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. And what they do is they take the collective buying power of all of us and direct it towards high-powered law firms in your area so that you get access to a really fantastic lawyer for a very reasonable price. How reasonable? Like a dollar a day. 30 bucks a month is pretty good. It'll get you in the door. You can have them do all kinds of things for you if you want them to create your... Do you have a will? When was the last time you updated your will? Most people don't even have one. Good Lord, you can let the state get involved in your affairs after you die too? That sounds like a bad idea. But you got to have a will. You got to have a financial power of attorney, a medical power of attorney, all these things. They cost if you go to an attorney and have it drawn up. But I'll tell you what, if you're a member of Legal Shield, you can just have your attorneys draft all these documents for you. It's covered. It's part of what you pay a dollar a day for. You might as well knock it out. Hell, it'll pay itself off for years and years and years just on that one visit to your attorney alone. So take a look. We even built a website specific for this show, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com, because I like the idea of us no longer having to get pushed around by people that have access to lawyers or resources that we don't have. We know about the concept of lawfare. It's a real thing. People will push you around to the extent that they can. So listen, use this power for good, not evil. I don't want you going around threatening people with your attorney, but if there's a company out there that promised to do something and they reneged on it and they know that you're not going to do anything about it, maybe a letter from your attorney will help. You know, maybe your work is asking you to sign some new compensation agreement that has some sort of weird language in there about what you agree to do as far as medical injections or something like that. Don't sign it. Don't sign anything. Send it to your attorney first. You have a speeding ticket. You get one of those red light camera tickets. All those, just send everything to your attorney. Let them sort that out. That's why you've got it. So I'll tell you what, go to the website, see what you think. It's not just the legal shield component. They have an identity shield. They have a small business version. If you carry a gun, there's paperwork for gun owners and gun carriers there too. So go to the website, don'tgetpushedaround.com. Read for yourself if you want to. Pull the trigger. I think you'll get your money's worth and then some. Also to EMP Shield, they're our newest sponsor. They are building the best EMP shielding device out there. It was so well built that the military was actually asking them for ideas on it. We had Tag in here. He sits on their board of directors. He said he was sitting in that meeting when they asked for it. So, hey, look, man, they're building a great device. It works on your home, works on cars. It works on motorhome if you have one, or if you have a boat, or if you have a generator or something like that. They have bundle packages. So I'll tell you what, it'll protect you against, obviously, EMPs, solar flares. Hopefully we don't have one of those. And lightning, which I think is obviously a more reasonable and realistic thing. So take a look and go to empshield.com, read up about it. What you'll find is it's fitted to the household circuit breaker with just four wires. It installs like a type 2 surge protector. You could probably do it yourself. There's installation videos, not just on their site, but everywhere. But if otherwise, you could have an electrician swing by and install it for you. It's many times more efficient than a single-use military design. It can handle up to 40 EMP strikes. I hope you don't need it. I hope you don't, but if you've got it, you'll feel a lot better. So go to empshield.com and just read up about it. If this is the first time you're hearing about it, check it out. These devices actually exist. They'll help you out. And if you use the promo code MACRO, it'll save you quite a bit of money on your way out. So empshield.com, promo code MACRO. Okay, well, now let's get down to some real business. On the Union of the Unwanted a couple weeks ago, Monica was on and she mentioned something, and I said, I want to talk to you about that later. I want to talk to you about that in detail and macroaggression. So the host of the Propaganda Reports, the host of Deep Dives with Monica Perez, ladies and gentlemen, Monica Perez. How are you?
Thank you so much. Great. I flew in from New York yesterday to LA, and I had like 5 hours of no Wi-Fi on the plane.
Hell.
So I did like 12 pages of handwritten notes on the Milner-Fabian conspiracy, and it's not searchable, but no. I've got the information.
If it makes you feel any better, I've got stacks of papers with all my handwritten notes on the same stuff. So.
Do you use them? This is the thing. Do you actually go back and use them? Okay, because as long as you know where it is, you can get to it.
I have them in a binder. With the nice. Protected plastic sheets.
Wow.
So for each episode that I do, I handwrite everything out, all my notes. It's not scripted necessarily, but if I have a quote I want, or if I have stats that I want, I make sure I write it all down. And then when I'm done, I staple those sheets together and put it in a protective sleeve. And then I have a binder filled with all my shows.
Okay, I have a question. First of all, I could tell that because I listened to your show on the Fabians a month ago, and it was clearly well-organized, but definitely not scripted. So I admired that. I was very professional. As someone who's trained in radio, was not allowed to read. And I had a 3-hour show. It's like, wow, that guy knows what he's doing. Very nice. So I really enjoyed that. And I have to ask you a professional question because you're probably the only other person I can ask this of. I'm moving and I have like 5 banker boxes of that stuff because I did the exact same thing when I was in radio. So I've been doing this 11 years and I have like all the original stuff on the Boston Marathon bombing, on S Hook, on all of that. Do I throw it away?
No,
no way.
Keep it. You
so much
find.
Stuff.
you keep it and you have somebody scan it for you and digitize it and put it into some sort of filing system, I think.
I think I'd have to get a job that earned money to hire someone to do that for me. Although I have children.
There's some free labor.
Child labor.
And kids are usually pretty good with technology. They'll probably tell you how to use the scanner better than you would even know how to use it. I mean, I don't know.
That's true. And they owe me like 1,000 meals for every year they've been alive. So
that's
I feel
true.
Like
put them to work. get to scanning, kids.
That's actually a great idea because my daughter needs some money.
I think that these notes, I mean, I know people have said like, you should type it all out. You know, you should type it all out and have it in a digital format. You're right. I should. I absolutely should. But that But when I'm doing notes and everything, I handwrite it out and I do it in a way that makes sense to me. And then I've got the pages in front of me so that I'm not looking on a computer screen necessarily. So I don't know. I'm old.
I want to tell you That's one cool. thing. I know not to get too inside baseball, but I have to say, because I did that for so many years and I tried like every possible permutation, and this is general information people should know, the relationship that you have with your material when you write it by hand, like, actually changes how you remember it.
Yes.
And you can find it, and it gives a spatial, like, you know, you can fit it in, or, oh, that was right after this. And there is value to it. That's why, of course, I'm skeptical of everything. So I feel like digitizing how you store information through your fingertips is not as good as with pen and paper.
It's not. And writing it out helps a lot. Writing in general. I mean, obviously writing books, or if you're typing it, so you're sort of over the material, but physically sitting down and handwriting everything does make it, it sort of sticks in a little bit more.
And no surveillance.
Exactly. So. I write it all on flash paper so that when the feds come, I can just light it on fire and it all goes away.
It disappears.
I don't have to eat all of these pages. I can just light them on fire.
Yes,
no, I'm not that paranoid. Not yet, at least. I mean, the day's not over, so there's still room. But
we'll see what happens. I mean, who would have thought before COVID? Like, every little thing, like when 9/11, when I already had a radio show before I realized 9/11 was an inside job. And I used to still talk like a libertarian. It'd be like, you know, the government has contrary incentives to ours. Like, eventually they will put us in danger so that they can save us from danger. And then I was like, oh, crap. Like, we already did that. And then the same thing with COVID. I was just like, you know, they're really pathological. Like, they could make you sick to make you buy medicine. It's like, oh, crap.
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, when you're early, you sound crazy. But
yes.
It doesn't mean that you are. It just means that you're earlier than the established allowance of skepticism. Now we're starting to see, like, people talk about Tucker Carlson. Oh, Tucker's talking about the things that need to be said. True, he's talking about a lot of them, but he's talking about them at a time when it's safer. I mean, you should have been with us 2 years ago.
I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop on that one. But So save your notes. So, like, the answer is save your notes. If you're ahead of the game, save your notes.
Show your work. Yeah.
Show your work. Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, when you were on your flight and you were taking these notes, I'm curious because let's do this. Let's just start from the beginning. What is the Milner-Fabian conspiracy?
Okay. So I will tell you, when we talked last time, I got about 3/4 of the way through the book. And for me, what was great about this book, and it was really hard to find, a listener said, you know, can anybody find this? We were tweeting about it. Finally, somebody in Australia tracked it down and I have a hard copy of it. So I was super excited for it. But I will say that, like, as I read it, there wasn't a lot of stuff that was like, oh, wow, I had no idea. The two biggest things that I felt were valuable about it is, like, it laid out a lot of stuff that we all kind of take as common knowledge in our circles, but the rest of the world doesn't necessarily. Gives you a narrative and very easy to understand, and documents it all. So it's got an amazing bibliography. It names names on who were Fabians, who were Milnerites. I know what the difference is now. Why they're not exactly the same, which I think will be interesting to you. And I'll tell you in a second. Well, I'll tell you right now, which is that it seems like the Fabians. So let's just talk about the formation of the UN. They were both involved in that. Fabians were Milnerites. The Fabians pivoted towards and supported and funded and made relationships with the USSR. And the Milnerites wanted the liberal American establishment in the fold. And that's kind of how they were differently facing. But if you look at the CFR, for example, which is basically established by more like the Milnerite, Morgan, whatever that, like the Rhodes, so it's very clear line to them rather than the Fabians, for specifically the CFR, which is also the Royal Institute of International Affairs and Chatham House, that you'll see, like, Arnold Toynbee, who was like the head researcher or something at Chatham House, was a Fabian, very closely associated fellow traveler. And Walter Lippmann, who was like a jack of all trades as far as the cathedral goes or whatever. Like, he was a famous media guy. He was an advisor to Wilson, and he was a professor at some point, I think. But he was one of the first contributors to Foreign Affairs magazine, which is the CFR outlet, and he's a known Fabian. So the idea is that there were a lot of relationships, that the funding was from the same entities, because it was really, no matter which way you sliced it, they wanted state capitalism. So competition is a sin. So if you can outlaw competition, I think that the Milnerites probably were more like they wanted to control it. And the Fabians were more like they wanted to control the capital, like at the monopoly, where the Fabians were like, let's put it all up at the state level and then control the state, the world government. I think maybe if there was any difference, it would be that. And I think you touched on that in your, and when I listen to your, what I'm going to call part one.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's call it part one. For sure. Yeah, because this is going to be part two.
Yes. So you said like they it's, you know, you can look at fascism as like the government is on top, or capital, you know, corporatism as the company's on top. And the Fabians seemed like they were taking a step from, Cecil Rhodes said he wanted to reestablish the British Empire. And the Fabians took that, morphed it, at least ideologically, if not actually, morphed it into the Commonwealth, which kind of eliminates the monarchical power, which is what like the Illuminati and stuff, they were all about, like, we don't have access to the monarchical power. So we need this to be secular, but we need to be able to control it. And they can't control the church or whatever. So they would take it out of the monarchy thing, but make that Commonwealth a stepping stone to the world government. And we can talk about all that.
Adding another step in the process towards world government. It's interesting that you said that one wanted to pivot to the Soviet Union, one wanted to go to the United States. So why? This was when the UN was forming, right? So were we talking early 50s?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it was like before. So the Fabian Society goes back before 1900, well before. And the Milnerites, I guess Milner was kind of the turn of the century guy with Rhodes. I forget the dates there, but they were around the same time. And I think their philosophies were pretty well established. And what the second thing I was going to say when I said there were two things, this isn't a long one, this is a short one. This book, which you may be familiar with, I think, I don't know if we've mentioned it before, but I've seen it around, Hidden History of the Secret Origins of the First World War. This is a great, great book. That would be more Milnerite.
Who wrote that?
This is Jerry Dougherty, I want to say, and Jim McGregor. Jerry Dougherty and Jim McGregor, they're cool. Scottish or whatever. But this is a great one. This is a page turner. This is like not, this is by a publishing house of, you know, whatever, a little higher quality material than that. This looks a little self-published, but
gotcha.
The Milner Fabian one. But this one about the hidden history, this is very clear about how the Milnerites manipulated foreign policy and events, specific events, and how many times they tried to get the World War I started. And this was all about, you know, kind of transforming the world and the culture. And that is, even though these are the Milnerites, that's the Fabian thing. It's like, you're going to transform everything about the world. Your thing about, you know, the shield that has the wolf in sheep's clothing in there, and their famous stained glass window that says, closer to the heart's desire. So they are trying to reform the world. And the best way to do that is through war. And that's what they went for World War I.
Did they kick off World War I? You think?
Yeah. So this one is the Milnerites. Yeah, the Milnerites. But it's the when you read just the same, like this book, it says how an international elite is taking over and destroying Europe, America, and the world. There's like the last three chapters though really fucking threw me for a loop. So we'll get to that later.
Okay.
Totally. Like, don't let me like sign off without being like, but.
Okay. I'll make a note.
So when you read this, the blue book that I'm talking about, the Milner Fabian conspiracy, it's just the same names go over and over again, but there are people who were in the Milner circle on the round table, which is the Cecil Rhodes thing. I think that's, they call it also the Cliveden set, and Winston Churchill was a part of that. Winston Churchill was definitely a fellow traveler of the Fabians. I don't think he was a member of the society. So he clearly delineates who were the actual Fabians and who weren't. But you can see that the Milnerite guys, like the real big money guys, the people who supported it, the capitalists, whatever you want to call them, robber barons, they there was just tons of overlap. Like he just, there's just like the law firms and the banks and everything that were involved by the time it gets to the UN, those people, it was like, they operated in parallel, but I would say it was coordinated, highly coordinated. But the Millenarite guys, yeah, in the Secret Origins of First World War, like they kept trying to create strife and conflict between England and Germany. And the Kaiser kept being like, yeah, this isn't that big a deal. We're just going to like not worry about it, not worry about it, not worry about it. And that just kept happening. Yeah. So eventually they got it done with the Archduke. But even then, it was really pulling teeth. And then there's another book, a sequel called Prolonging the Agony. So for World War One, World War Two, and I might say COVID, which was World War Three, in my opinion, there are turning points where it could have been over. They almost have to restart the war. And I, of course, feel like every time they rolled out a new jab, like that was them like prolonging the agony.
And even in Ukraine, there were opportunities for peace there that they want to prolong it. And they go, no, we're not going to do that. And listen, let's come to the table and let's talk this out. What, like a couple months in, they said, nope, we're not interested. So they don't want to end wars.
Gaddafi, Saif, who I think you said was a Fabian, went to the London School of Economics, which is absolutely Fabian established. Like that's what people don't really understand. Fabians established London School of Economics. They established the later party, Labour Party. And that's what I think is the most crucial thing. But the thing about Gaddafi is Saif called Kucinich. Do you remember that call?
No.
Saif called Kucinich and said, there are these terrorists that are cutting people's heads off. And I know they're like Chechen or something, but we're allies. And, you know, like you can't let this, you know, like the world opinions, like my father's doing this. That's insane. He was a Rothschild friend. So like there's no loyalty there. Yeah. And Kucinich was like, I really have no idea what you're talking about, but it was hidden audio. When it came out, Kucinich was like, I have no idea where that came from, but it was clearly on his end because it was, you could hear Saif like being long distance and you could hear Kucinich not, but it was very clear. So, even though he was in the Fabians, hold on, I got sidetracked with the Saif al-Islam thing. The Gaddafi thing.
You were saying that London School of Economics and the Labour Party are created.
Yes, they're all the exact, like, oh, so this is what I think is so interesting about the whole thing, is that you look at this old history, the hidden history of World War One. You look at all that, like Cecil Rhodes and Colonel House, who basically controlled Woodrow Wilson and all that.
Yeah.
And you can see like the advent of the CFR, you can see the advent of the UN, but there's this phenomenon where like facts get stale. Like they're allowed to just like Seymour Hersh, like forgets, you know, about 9/11. There's like, why, you know what I'm saying? Like he can say all he wants, but why is he not saying 9/11 was an inside job? You know, like why does he get to have a pass on that? Like they just let facts get old. And I ask people, like, if you knew, like any old school liberal, you knew the Republicans did 9/11, how can you call me a conspiracy theorist? Like the conspiracy is unbelievable. So what I find really interesting about the Fabian connection is they are still totally active. They are still calling the shots for the Labour Party. And I never saw any manifesto that changed their philosophy. And their philosophy is like what you said, which is like completely transform everything about the world and make a world government that they can control. But it's like specifically social, political, like religious, it's economic. I think those might be the four pillars.
Legal,
that are like
from the courts as well. They always love that. They've got to control those people. If you've got to control that, you got everything, really.
But they're doing it. Yes, and they're doing it. They're doing that incrementalism and their goals have not changed. And they are literally like replaced basically the Liberal Party with the Labour Party. They even in this book, so this book gets a little sketchy. He talks about how they infiltrated the Freemasons, like the Fabians infiltrated the Freemasons. But like, you got to go back pretty far to have the Freemasons are the infiltrators, right? So like who's infiltrating the Freemasons? So they act like, yeah, that they infiltrate the Freemasons. But so I was in London and I went to the Jack the Ripper Museum, which is hilarious. Mm-hmm. It's like a $20 thing and like you pay for it. And it's, you know, it's not like a museum. It's like a museum. It's like an attraction.
Yeah.
So I went in there and there's a very prominent theory about Jack the Ripper. And I, by the end, really believed it, even though they didn't push it, which is that It was a Freemason plot to usher in the welfare state. Because, yes, and I absolutely believe it, because the Jack the Ripper stuff was so gruesome, it defies the imagination. Like, you wouldn't even think of doing the shit that they did then, where you don't have, like, all this video, like, only the fucking psycho eugenicists and stuff do it. So you look at it and you're like, oh, obviously, like, what the hell? Because it was, like, a skillful person, and he never got caught and all that. So I noticed that Beatrice Webb, who you mentioned on your show, Sydney and Beatrice Webb, were, like, really foundational Fabians. And they wrote a lot. So one big thing about the Fabians is they document everything. Like, they write the tracts. They write the directions. They write the instructions of how the incrementalism needs to be carried out, what the goals are. Mm-hmm. You can find all the stuff. So that, you know, so what I was saying was found so interesting is, like, there's a straight line of the past 150 years or whatever of what their goal was, how to do it. And it's still active and alive today. It's, like, continuously existing.
Yeah.
So I looked, like, the advent of the welfare state idea was the Minority Report. There was a Majority Report. I don't know, whatever. But Beatrice wrote the Minority Report on, like, the state of, you know, how to think about the poor, like, to stop thinking about the poor as a problem of, like, getting individual skills and motivation and responsibility, and start thinking of it as a collective problem. And there was a lot. And that's, of course, like, the stepping stone to this Fabian stuff is that they're promising you that there's not going to be any that you're going to get the goodies. They're not telling you. They don't start with, we're going to control all the production at the top. They start with, you're going to get, like, be taken care of, like the nanny state. All of that came from there. And they were having a hard time getting that kind of idea to stick. So I looked, and it let me see if I wrote the dates down. I think I did. So Jack the Ripper, so I have to look up the dates. Anyway, they ushered in. So there was a big thing about Jack the Ripper, like, it all took place among poor people, among the prostitutes and everything, or charwomen. And nobody really worried about it, because, like, those people live in squalor. So the fear that was being promulgated by people who wanted a bigger welfare state was, it's going to cross over. Like, if you don't pay them to stay on their side of the wall, it's going to cross over. So I believe it was the last Jack the Ripper murder was, like, on the other side. It was, like, a person who didn't deserve it.
See, you know? We told you it was going to cross over unless you finance this welfare state, and then we'll manage the collapse of the welfare state in order to build it back in our image or whatever.
Yeah, and that was
phase two.
Cloward and Piven. Yeah, like in the
Cloward and Piven. 60s. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, so I just feel like it's, I would want to double check the dates, but it seems like the Minority Report wanted to change into this welfare thing. And there was a sticking point, and Jack the Ripper was designed, they say, by Freemasons, which Fabian supposedly infiltrated and did the same thing, actually accomplished it.
Jack the Ripper, problem, reaction, solution.
Totally. No, numero uno. Yeah. They, like,
problem. Definitely. We need to start this welfare center. Reaction. We've got a maniac on the loose who's killing all these people. You know, solution. Here we go.
He's coming for you. Like, yeah, he's coming for you. It's random. It's like school shootings. It's like, there's nothing you can do.
Or terrorists or viruses.
Right.
They're just around the corner waiting to murder you.
Even if you don't do anything wrong. It's out of your control. You don't even have to be a good person.
No. In fact, it's just random chance. So you should be fearful all the time, because random probability says that today could be your day. So be fearful, and then definitely we'll give control to the state to look after you.
And not only does that keep you scared of things that are beyond your control, it kind of demotivates you to control what you can control.
Right.
Like, why get out of bed and work hard? Like you were saying about AOC, like, you know, we'll give you money even if you don't want to work. It's like, well, if it doesn't matter, then don't work.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned this, that was a sort of a tactic. First step was not, we'll control the means of production. First step was, we're going to give you the stuff you want, right? Who's giving you stuff you want? AOC is said in her Green New Deal, you know, this is going to be for people that work, or if they don't want to work. And you read that and you go, what? You're going to give away the farm to people that don't want to work? What is this? Communism? And the answer is, well, no, communism has such a bad name, right? This is democratic socialism. This certainly isn't Fabianism.
And how do you get people to work if they get the same whether they work or not. Like, there's only one way, like a whip, you know, like that's it.
Carrot or the stick. That's there's
so we're trying to see. 1888 was the was Jack the Ripper, and the Minority Report was published between 1905 and 1909. So I believe the tide of public opinion had turned in the wake of Jack the Ripper. And, you know, sometimes you have OKC, but you don't get the Patriot Act. So,
right.
For another 15 years. Yeah. So
it's incremental.
Like that. Yes.
The OKC is one thing, but, you know, it's Oklahoma City and who goes there, and it's the FBI building, who goes there. But if it's New York City and it's two commercial buildings that you come and go, I've been in the World Trade Center towers before. You know, I mean, anything can happen then, right? You know?
And they have a thing where they study this is what I think the school shootings are, is that they have an idea of what, like, the critical mass of, like, events or deaths or whatever it is that will change public opinion. So it doesn't really have to be, like, the one pivotal event. It just has to, it has to, like, reach a crescendo and then change minds. And actually, that was a Fabian quote. I think it was Shaw. I forget who it was. One of these guys who was mentioned by name was, like, you're not going to get socialism until you change minds. And and he didn't mean, like, change people's minds. He meant change the mind. And that's, you know, they work so hard on that, it seems like to me.
Yeah. Well, I will give these people one bit of credit, if there is any credit to give them, is that they take a long-term approach. That I mean, hell, they're the Fabian's mascot or logo was a tortoise, right? So they do take a long-term
approach. And Fabius.
Fabius. Yeah. Exactly. So this is a grinding. This is a long, long game. The totalitarian tiptoe, as the great David Icke says, right? So you don't go from A to Z all at once. You just make these incremental moves. But I wonder now, though, because we're in a society where everything is today, this second. Hell, you can't even wait 3 days for Amazon to deliver. It's got to be here this afternoon. So, are we in a society that could even control themselves? The AOCs and not that she's in charge of anything, but, you know, the group that's running things, can they still, I wonder, show that same sort of patience and discipline?
Well, actually, I would say the opposite, that it's, you know how evolution, and we can totally talk about evolution, I hate even to use the word, but it can absolutely function in a colony of bacteria, say, because the multiplication, there's so many generations in such a short amount of time, and there's so many organisms at work that you can actually accelerate the rate of change. So that it could be that they are accelerating the rate of change because they can, and that will speed this up. I mean, I don't know, because that's so, like, meta to think, not meta.
So you're saying they're bacteria.
Saying we're the bacteria.
Oh, we're the bacteria, unfortunately.
But we have souls. That's the thing about them, this elite, is that they are super smart, but I really feel like there's a pathology there where they kind of don't have souls and they don't understand the soul. And that might be their weakness, is that we do have souls. And, like, until they get rid of that, maybe the little jab is meant to do that. But
yeah. Well, also, I'll tell you, there's an interesting sort of thread that's running through a lot of these guys at the higher levels, the Cecil Rhodes of the world, and these high ranking late 1800s, early 1900 maniac guys. A lot of them were closeted homosexuals as well. And I wonder, I'm not saying that the gay community has anything to do with this, but I wonder how your mentality is different when you have no offspring in the game.
Hoppe, I think Hoppe got suspended for a year or fired or whatever, sued at the University of Nevada, if I'm not mistaken, because he said, like, it's a proven fact that people who don't have children have a shorter time frame for how they think about, you know, planning. So, you know, when, like, a little kid, they say like more intelligent kids will take, like, two marshmallows tomorrow.
Right.
Rather than one today, like, and, you know, or older kids will do that. So if you feel like you could give one of those marshmallows to an offspring You might wait 2 days to get three.
Right.
But you would never do that if you have no offspring. And that's all he was saying. Like, if you're homosexual or barren or like a priest or nun or whatever, like, right. That's why, you know, nuns and priests can't get married, because they're not allowed to have this idea of their own, you know, legacy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not even saying this so much as it's necessarily a homosexual
it's just
only
a biological
component.
Fact that they're not going to have biological children with someone they love.
But I even put myself in this category of when I didn't have my daughter until I was old. I was 39, and there was a part of me that was like, well, maybe I'll never have kids. But once I did, I felt like it reset the timer on everything. Like, okay, now I have to care about everything, not just for my lifetime, but now for her lifetime as well. So it restarted the clock on me having to, not that I'd be like,
no,
oh, I don't care about the world, but
you have an obligation to them, and it's annoying.
it extends out the timeline even longer. Now totally. I have to worry about the world that she's going to live in the whole time.
You have to save a little bit, maybe.
You have to save, you have to do things differently. So I just always wondered once I got a hold of this information that these guys all had this one thing running through them, it's a thought, you know, I'm not saying that it necessarily had anything to do with their mentality, but it very well could.
No, and there's a few things that it also could be because they didn't, you know, it wasn't attractive to them to get married and have kids. Maybe they had the extra time and effort, you know what I mean? Like you,
sure.
I wonder if they did a wealth study of gay guys in New York versus in fashion or something with women who have kids and stuff in fashion. Like, I bet you're going to have a huger wealth gap than straight men and women.
There's even an acronym for it. God knows everyone that listens to this show knows I love acronyms. DINK, dual income, no kids.
Right. Exactly.
That's a thing. So yes. You're going to have more disposable income, you're going to have more time, you're going to have more, you know, if it wasn't for my daughter, I could be plotting world destruction by now, you know?
Or have money to like name a wing after yourself. So like, I think that's right. A nice analogy for how it might work is that like my father would see people who named the wings and he'd be like, they're definitely not Catholics because that kind of like imagery is not okay. Like the pride. Mm-hmm. And he said, like, he thought those were people who needed they yearned for immortality, but they did not think they were going to get it.
They didn't have it in through children. They had it instead by naming a building
or faith. Like, but either way, like anything, you know, there is a need for immortality. And, you know, that, and there, these could be traits that are correlated. I mean, it could be like, you know, like men, there are definitely traits that are correlated with men in hunting. You know, or whatever, versus women, like they're and nurturing. I definitely think that I'm a better nurturer as a female, but you know, it could be because I bore the kids. I'm not sure if it's correlated or causal or whatever, but there could also be correlated traits in the, you know, gay people or lesbians or whatever. Didn't they say like after the Hitler, there were more men born gay, like just the stress of in the womb. Oh yeah, you've never heard that. I'm not saying I don't know for sure it's true, but it was definitely like cited as a study. Like there was like a spike in homosexual births.
Interesting.
Births of people who turned out to be homosexual because they were wondering if it was like a stress hormone thing or you don't want you know, maybe there's correlations with aggression, maybe you know, internally. So we could talk a little bit about evolution if you want.
Let's do. Since we've been on this, and a lot of these ideas come out of this round table and they come out of this eugenics group and they come out of Darwin and Galton and these guys that are talking about how, you know, on the origins of species, and this book comes out and everyone goes, you know, like some people read it and went, I feel stupid for never figuring this out. I mean, I think that was sort of the philosophy of some of these guys. They felt like, how could I have missed this? It's so obvious. Thomas Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, read the book and said, I forget what his exact words were, something along the lines of like, how stupid of me to not see this rather obvious connection.
Well,
right,
he would say that. He would say that because he was in on it.
Right.
So it was definitely, in my opinion, like without question, well, not without question, but I firmly believe that it was designed like a lot of, quote, you know, science that's trying to explain the origin of things. It's supposed to eliminate the concept of the prime mover unmoved. Like, you don't need a god if you have the Big Bang, if you have Darwinian evolution. Mm-hmm. I actually do not think that it answers the question of the origin of the material world or the universe. I don't think any of those things do, but I believe that that's where it was all coming from. And that's why it was fostered. But where I have a problem with Darwin, I actually do think there is marginal evolution. Like, I definitely think that over a long enough timeline, you could have a pointier beak if you live on an island.
you could have a spotted breed of animals that's better suited in their environment where they're more camouflage as opposed to the same version.
Absolutely.
That's bright
camo.
Red and stands out, you know.
Camo gets selected.
We see moths that develop this. Yes, we see these definitely. Sorts of evolutionary things. But on top of the common denominator of them, of these people all being closeted homosexuals, which may or may not play a role in this, one thing that most definitely does is that they're all atheists.
Yes, I believe that. They certainly act like it. Yeah. And that will get to the punchline of this book that we could not. So think about that for a second. But my problem with Darwin is the name of his book was The Origin of Species. And in my opinion, actually, it cannot be The Origin of Species because that would be mathematically impossible. Like, I already concluded that, like, and I kept looking through books and I don't know where I was stalling. Maybe it was before I was good at searching, but I could never find anyone do the math. And then, of course, I have, like, my son is next gen. So he's just like, is this what you were looking for, Mom? And he, like, sends me the math. And so it's just mathematically impossible to have, because the concept of Darwin is that at every mutation would have to wipe out all the competitors in your species for that mutation to be adopted by everyone. Otherwise, it would get washed out, right? So if I all of a sudden had purple eyes and I couldn't find anybody to mate with purple eyes and everybody else was mating with blue eyes and brown eyes, like, there's just no way purple eyes would dominate 7 billion people or even ever be seen. That's why I actually think blue-eyed people are Neanderthals, but we can talk about that some other time.
How dare you?
I know, sorry. Maybe they were better. I don't know. So maybe Neanderthals have a bad name.
My wife would probably back you up on this claim.
You're a Neanderthal. So it's just that every single allele, like every single mutation, even if it didn't have like a functional benefit. So your eyeball is more than one allele away from an eye spot. But is every subsequent mutation something that wiped out the rest of the species? Because that's what a brown moth and a white moth, it wiped out the rest of the species. Somebody, some fucking pterodactyl, which didn't really exist, came down and ate all the white moths because all of a sudden the trees were brown again. So that it's not, that can't be true. I believe that, you know, I think my math is right. Usually pretty good, simple arithmetic. But what can be true, which I think is probably the real truth, and it is where epigenetics is going, but it was basically hinted at, if not proven, in 1925 by this guy named Kammerer. And there's a book by Arthur Koestler who wrote The 13th Tribe. Mm-hmm. So you know what The 13th Tribe is? It's a great book. This guy was some kind of intelligence officer type, you know, like Orwell or whatever.
Right.
And but he writes great stuff. I mean, Limited Hangouts, I get a lot out of them. And I think he was preparing. He wrote this book called The Case of the Midwife Toad. He wrote that in like 1970. And I think he was preparing the world for epigenetics because he knew Darwin was going to be on the rocks pretty soon. So he wrote this, like, nobody even ever heard of Kammerer, but look at what he did before he shot himself twice in the back of the head.
Of course.
Of course. So what he had done was he was so masterful at raising frogs in captivity that he raised so many frogs that they were land frogs, and he raised them in water. And the water frogs that were similar to these land frogs had little sticky pads so they could affix to the female. Like, I don't even understand, like, if frogs have dicks, I just don't know. But apparently they have to glue themselves together in the water to get close enough to procreate. But the land frogs don't have to do that. So he would take the almost identical land frogs, and after, I think it took him 10 years, I don't know how many generations, new frogs that used to be land frogs were born with those sticky pads. Hmm. So So they were aware at some subcellular level that the right genes to turn on. See, this is where I think is what's happening. So they say, oh, you have like 90% of your genome is like a mystery. And I'm like, no, I think 90% of your genome are these backup mutations. So like Darwin would work if he said you accumulate jillions of mutations over a billion years and they turn on and off based on some kind of interaction, communication with the environment. But that would imply some kind of subcellular intelligence, and they have not cracked the code on what that might be. But right. I think that Kammerer has proven, did prove, and he was like an absolute target of like the Royal Society of whatever science. And like they said, he was cheating, but he didn't. And maybe he was suicidal because they were so rude to him. He was on his way to Russia because they wanted him and, you know, packed his bags and then stopped to shoot himself twice in the head. Whatever. But anyway, I feel like he showed that Lamarck was closer to the mark than Darwin, because there had to have been, and I think the like epigenetics thing is called developmental plasticity. And it's that like you, once you turn those genes on, they're the ones you're passing down.
Okay.
Until something else happens. But you're like developmentally, something had to know to turn those genes on. And what is that? That's some information that the parent organism is imparting.
Gotcha.
And that's why I think like, so Darwin is wrong.
So Darwin's wrong on that. But it's, well, but now we're getting into genetics. We're getting into this whole idea that you can, Gattaca, right? The movie. Oh, well, just make it so that your baby looks like this. What do you
totally.
Want?
Totally.
Blue eyes, green eyes, and red
that's the
eyes, whatever.
Draw. Ding, that's ding, the ding. Draw to get us yes. to invest in the transhumanism.
Yeah, yeah, and of course we've come to understand that transhumanism is just a rebranding of eugenics, and when you start talking about eugenics, you're talking about genetics and epigenetics,
and the immortality, the drive for immortality, because these people have no souls; they can't conceive of the human being as having a soul, which is why they think they can achieve, you know, upload.
I listened to Harari speak at the World Economic Forum or wherever he speaks.
Ouch.
Boy, I'll tell you.
Painful.
You talk about a guy who has some sort of bizarre God complex, desire to live forever. Again, back to this, not going to have kids. Never going to pass that on.
There is a lot. I think it all because it's we're, and maybe we're wrong to be, it's actually a burden. It's not like I'm satisfied with the idea that I have to have responsibility towards my offspring forever or towards my soul for the afterlife. But boy, does it make for a much better society if you have to model behavior for your children, if you have to be industrious, if you have to take care that you don't go to hell instead of purgatory. Like if so we have talked about this before, whether there's a God or not, and you know, whatever. But I finally came to the conclusion that my mother, and I mean since the last time I talked to you, that my mother came to when she was 19. And that was because I'm like, well, how do you know there's a God? How do you know there's a God? And all she would say, and now I finally get it, I just decided it's a better way to live. It's just a better way to live. It's a better way to live. So
I don't care what you say. The sun is hot
that's
today.
What she says. That's so funny.
That's what you said.
You've been reading my tweets. She says that to people. She's like, I don't care what you say. Starts with that. And then, but she's the other day. She's like, I don't care what you say. That sun is hot. That sun is hot. And I'm like, did I ever say the sun was not hot?
There's a big contingent of people that are very anti-sun out there. Your mother knows what she's
speaking
of.
She might know. All right, so I have to tell you the crazy ending of the Milner-Fabian conspiracy.
I'm interested to know about this.
The last three chapters, I was like, it's all the titles are, it's like Islamization, multiculturalism, and immigration. So his idea, so this is like, I don't know if there's a new generation, but I feel like I was completely raised in a post-racial, racist, like, I am so uncomfortable even observing that someone has race, like that there is race. I can't stand it. They're driving. It's like trans stuff. I'm like, whatever. I'm a libertarian. Do whatever you want. But, you know, like Pete Q says, like, until you find out they cut your daughter's tits off. And it's like, okay, then you gotta, you know, like, so that's why they're pushing it that far, so they can get people like me to entertain the idea that we should like have conflict. And I hate that. I'm so non-conflict. But what he's saying, so this guy's like anti, he feels like it's like he's a precursor of the replacement theory thing. So like, he's like, they did two things. Like Clement Attlee, who was the first Labour president, or he was maybe the second one, but he was a Fabian. Mm-hmm. He was a Labour prime minister. And he did two things, which is he made the Nationality Act. So that was, and you know it, man, I went to London and there were way more non-British people there.
Oh,
British now, but like there were way more former colony people.
Oh yeah. I was there in 2019 and the last time I had been to London was 89. And so it had been 30 years. And I was like,
it's been abandoned. It's like pizza made by Italians in New York. Like you're not finding a slice of pizza in New York made by an Italian, not even Greeks anymore. I don't even know what they're at now, but like the Italians moved to the suburbs. Now the Italians like moved to LA and then the Greeks like took over the thing that they moved to the suburbs. Like you are not getting like a British pub run by British people anymore.
No, it was very multicultural. And
that's another thing. Yeah.
I don't know that, I mean, listen, I'm all for experiencing all kinds of culture.
Look at my face. You traveling. Think I'm not from a colony? I'm Syrian. Like, obviously,
right?
You know, but.
But it is. But when you grow up and everything looks one way and then it starts to change and then you start to hear these policies being, you know, enacted and you find like, you know, we know about George Soros destabilizing and then leading these marches of migrants up there. Okay. It's like, well, it's organized. Okay. And if it's organized, somebody's organizing it. And if they're taking the time to organize it and spend the money, then it must be being done on purpose for a reason. So the question, it's not unreasonable to ask, why are all of these migrants coming here? Of course, the answer is more complicated than that. It's part of it is like with regard to our southern border, it's, well, maybe we're destabilizing Central America pretty badly. And we've been doing this for a while and we've been creating these conflicts. But again, it's being made to happen. So it's not accidental. It's not your imagination. You're not a racist for noticing it. You're just being observant. And when I was in London, I was like, whoa, I wasn't saying this is the worst thing I've ever seen.
You can't deny it.
I wasn't saying it was the best thing I've ever seen. I was just saying it is undeniable that London looks like Pakistan.
Yeah, or like a trading planet on Star Trek, like where there is no indigenous population.
You've got Greedo in the corner. You've got a bunch. Like,
there's
you've got
no
the band,
indigenous
and
population.
They're from a different planet, and you know everyone's from a different planet. They're all meeting in this one place. That's London.
Which here, like, I can see how we might be more prone to that because our culture is economic and not like indigenous persons. We have indigenous people and they are not the dominant race here, but there. So Clement Attlee did that in two ways, like overtly with policies that clearly did this. And he was the first Labour guy, which is the Fabian. He did the Nationality Act, which was, and you could see it, like it was, you can see with your eyes that it did exactly this. It made everyone in the Commonwealth or in the British Empire, whatever it was called at the time, because like was, I think that was in the 40s, basically citizens for all intents and purposes, gave everybody a green card in every colony of Britain. I mean, just think of that. If you give everyone in India a green card, think if you did that here, like if you gave everybody in India a green card,
right,
you would have a lot of people from India because there's a billion people there and they don't have as much money as we have. So they're going to come over here.
Obviously. Of course.
Yeah. That's what you're going to do. So that he did that. And then the other thing was a stated goal. And Tony Blair also had the stated goal, which was, but I think Attlee actually changed the policy from assimilation to multiculturalism, or I think they called it cultural diversity. So they actually made the decision not to assimilate the populations. And then I'll tell you what I think.
Oh, to create conflict?
It goes to the thesis, antithesis, synthesis thing. So the clash of civilizations, the what do you call it? The dialectic. So they did that. So he did that. And then, so now you have all these pockets. So of course you can keep racism alive forever if you're competing over the same territory with different values and rules of how to operate your business. What's arm's length? If you have a double ethic, a few cultures don't have a double ethic where you treat each other better if you're from your community and your mother knows your mother, you know, as opposed to like one of those outsider gringos, whatever.
Right.
So, but the reason I think, so what he's saying is that, he's like fucking crazed about it. Like, and he doesn't realize 9/11 is an inside job. So like this, you know, don't read past chapter 7. So, but what he says is, so he says that they're doing it because for two reasons. One is they want to, he says the two reasons are they're going to have to incorporate Islamic countries into the world government. So they need to pave the way for that. Gotcha. And the other reason is because it's like a brotherhood, and it has like more of a like hierarchical structure, has the concept of Sharia law, that it's a better culture to dominate than like the Western culture that grew up with this competition between like kings. He doesn't say this, but I think between king and church. So that individualism, I think, emerged, you know, because between industrialization and capitalism and all that happening while kings and the church were competing for you, you had value as an individual. Whereas some religions or like Chinese or whatever dynasties, like there was no competition for the power at the top. So like the person didn't really have anyone to choose. There was no teams.
Gotcha.
So there's that. But I think he also makes another point that the Fabians consider Islam as revolutionary and Christianity as reactionary. And it was just a passing comment, but the way they use the expressions revolutionary and reactionary, which is something I only read recently, is like revolutionary is like communist revolution, change everything. Reactionary is when the old culture that you're trying to radically alter reacts and resists it. And it, like, to me, reactionary is supposed to be a bad word, but I'm like, I'm fucking reactionary. I'm always reactionary. Like, don't even, you know, like, I just like, you know, I've been working under these premises. I want to not change it.
Right. That sounds reasonable. I mean, that's a, okay.
So here's where I think the two things that I think, and they do play a little bit off of what he says, but the two things that I think, one is that, you know, why would they want to bring in Islam when they don't believe in God or anything? Like, that's like not, doesn't have like a value. And I would say, and he never mentions, I think there's like one sentence where he says like Israel, or like never mentions any of like the theories that like it's the Jews run everything or whatever, which I also think is a trap. But you have to recognize that there, that Rothschild had an idea about a homeland, like, and did,
for sure.
You know, if you read Konigsby by Disraeli, I believe it was Disraeli, who was like the first Jewish prime minister, maybe the only one. He wrote Konigsby, which is like just a little novel. And there's a character in there supposed to be Rothschild. And this was from, you know, well over 100 years ago or 100 years ago, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he explains that, you know, he's got beef. So he's got beef with the indigenous culture that he's had to conform with and been treated as a second-class citizen, even though he was superior to them. So there's a possibility that this folds in. And what you wouldn't, so why would you bring Islam? You know, why would you want to promote that in the world? And my idea was, whoever is on the top, regardless of their motive or if there's an ethnic thing, I don't think there is. I think it's an international elite, pretty clearly, that's secular. But if whoever it is, they can, it's kind of like the red blue thing here, Democrats and Republicans, there's an elite that's above the fray, but they just need the fray. They need the fray, and the fray will neutralize itself. And, but I looked at his like, shrill, like freaking out about Islam. And I thought, we don't have that here. We have the Latin thing here. So our immigrants aren't Islamic, they're Latin. And that's like Catholic. Like, that would be a real threat if you were really trying to whatever. So I don't think it's like what he thinks it is, but I do think his idea about world government does play in, because if you think of it, if he said the early Fabians wanted a European United States, United States of Europe, they're also kind of working on that in the Middle East. And then they also have gap bridgers, like they have the EU, like Union for the Mediterranean States or whatever. Like, they have unions between Europe and the Middle East. And then I just thought about, like, what is the Trilateral Commission, which is associated with all these guys? The laterals were like North and South America. It's like Europe and African stuff. And then there's Asia. So Europe is, you know, it looks like they're all supposed to integrate, regionalize North, South. And that's what we're doing. And that's what they're doing. I don't know what's happening in China, but Russia and China, I guess they're doing it too.
Yeah, that's happening.
And then you've got some cross-border stuff like Africa and China, India, like kind of straddles, Russia kind of straddles, whatever. So I just feel like it does play into the idea that first you set up the three lats, you know, the tri-lats, and then you just zip them up on the oceans or whatever. So I can see where he's getting. I might as well be reading The Looming Tower at a certain point like this. I don't know if you were around when this was being pushed by like every Republican radio host, by Lawrence Wright, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. It's like, if it doesn't say like Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, exactly.
Not really. There's not a lot of value here, but I will tell you one thing. I do have this other book I wanted to recommend to you because it was, you know, just because we're having this conversation, that was written before 9/11. And these books are great because they don't get tainted with the brush of conspiracy. Mm-hmm. It's called Dollars for Terror. I think it's translated from French. The guy's name, it's called Dollars for Terror, the United States and Islam. Richard Labeviere. Labeviere. I did take French. I should know how to say that at least. Labeviere. Labeviere. E with a little noogie on top. Anyway, so this is a great, you know, I highly recommend this for the library, your own library. Whereas this one, the Milner Fabian conspiracy, which was like super expensive, unfortunately. I do like that the narrative, like the first seven chapters, and like it's very narrative oriented. It really names names, and the bibliography is just to die for. Or I should say, like the end notes of the chapters. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if I were going to buy two books, I would buy The Dollars for Terror and Hidden History at this time.
I got to get Committee of 300 by John Coleman.
Oh, John Coleman, defo. He doesn't like immigrants either, but other than that, it's good. But I will say this, in his defense, there were three things he said in that book that I was like, see, that didn't happen. And I'll tell you, and all three did come true after. But he also opened my mind to the possibility that free trade is a mercantilist plot.
He hates free trade. He says it's not free.
Yeah, but it makes me question my own understanding of the nation state and the economic.
He says it's a one-way street. He describes free trade as a one-way street.
Yeah, like kind of the anarchism thing is, you know, also maybe a plot to destroy nation states, you know, which like if I get my anarcho-capitalist utopia, it's, or if I destroy the nation state, I'm not getting my anarcho-capitalist utopia. I'm getting world government. So I might want to slow that down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been to enough anarcho-pulcos. I mean, it's a great conference. There's a lot of interesting, fun people there.
I love it. I mean, my world would be, you know.
No, yeah, nobody wants the state there, but they also recognize, well, if the state goes away, that leaves a vacuum and it might be filled by something else even worse.
Because it's there, and because it's been, it is the sheep, you know, that the Fabians are the wolves inside that mechanism. So it's there, it's being controlled by our enemies and being sold to us in this idea of democracy. But one of them, I think Shaw said, George Bernard Shaw is like the big Fabian, probably the biggest. He said democracy is incompatible with socialism, and socialism is what they call their ideology. So when he says socialism, it's not like us like using it loosely. Socialism, his world domination and controlling the means of production at the top, is incompatible with democracy. And I'm not saying I love democracy, but the idea of the demos having anything to do with it is it's just not going to happen. So they are there controlling it. They have created this mechanism. They've created dependence on the mechanism. And it's not as organic as, you know, as Hoppe says, it was just, you know, it was just this horrible social error to have this all-powerful government. It's going to be hard to get away from that. So we'll have to crack that code in our lifetime.
What's on your agenda? What's on your agenda next? for the future, what are you guys talking about on Propaganda Report or deep dives or what are you into? Well, what's your new thing you're into? Because yes. I'm into that round table stuff, the depopulation Club of Rome, all this stuff, Committee of 300. That's sort of my new, I don't know, conspiracy du jour that I'm into. What are you into right now?
Yes. Well, I have had to I've had to spend a lot of time in New York with my mom, and I also bought a house, and I've got like other little personal things. So I have had to stop doing a daily show. And so that was very like painful. So I'm not doing the Propaganda Report anymore. And someday I hope to be able to like do full time again. So what I do instead of that, because I did want to kind of that 80-20 rule, like I can probably get 80% of the value and 20% of the actual product. So I do lots of interviews and chats, which I love, and I find that to be just like leisure. But the work is like what you do with the part one of the Fabian thing. I do the deep dives, and one thing that I was really I had this cascade effect of like eight deep dives where I started with the housing and homelessness executive orders by Biden, the 15-minute cities thing, and now you know I bought a house in LA. I just like, it makes me sick just to think about it. But I've decided it's a really awesome house. It's got a little vineyard on it. The people next door have chickens. LA County is huge. So you can like almost be in the.
I lived there for 25 years.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So it's up against the mountains. Okay. So you know where I live now. Like if you just go just right up against the mountains from where I live, that's where I'm going to be living. They have fucking bears and everything. It's weird.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to try to focus on like property rights and how to protect them. Because one thing I think is really important, this is a very long-term big picture thing, but the thing that I think is most important is how do you straddle like the Benedict option, what the Catholics call it, or like the homesteading thing where you're just like, fuck it, I'm out, you know? Right. And instead of having to be forced into the tunnels where chickens do not grow, well, maybe chickens grow, but like, you know, whatever, lavender for a good cocktail does not grow. I feel like we need to pay attention to our water rights, our chicken rights, you know, and the 15-minute cities are coming. So I'm hoping to be able to incorporate not only some research, but also some like experiences and go along cool. the journey. Like the way some people are like showing you how they garden. Maybe I'll try to figure out how we defend the garden.
When I was a kid, like I remember my dad telling me, he said, if you want to get rich, there's two industries where you can get really rich: religion and bottled water.
And wow.
Like, and he says you can either be a preacher, one of those big preachers,
wow,
or you can figure out how to sell people water. And yeah. and now I've come to understand that it's water rights. It's what do the bushes own in South America, this big, gigantic freshwater deposit that they own in Guyana someplace, or one of those countries.
Yeah, because they stop the rain here. Like you can see it. People don't believe in chemtrails. It's like, dude, you can see it. Like you can see the rain is coming. And it just happens to me all the time. My husband will say, like, oh, it's going to rain tomorrow. I'm like, it's definitely not raining tomorrow.
It's not
like
on the schedule.
Yeah, you can see that they're like spraying the stuff and it just pushes the clouds down so it can't rain. And then we just had torrential rain for like a month straight.
Atmospheric rivers is what they were calling it.
Yes, they invented that.
Like, you guys.
I don't know. But yeah, so then you see like stuff just grows ever. I mean, it's crazy. Like I wouldn't be surprised if I planted an egg, a chicken wouldn't grow. Like this place is crazy. And they just don't want you to have that. So I think people have to, somebody's got to start paying attention. And I hate to be that person, but I might have to.
Well, you're the right person for it because you always get to the bottom of this stuff. So where's the best place for people to find you, to support your work, and to follow everything Monica Perez?
Thank you so much. So, of course, as you know, because we tweet at each other, at Monica Perez Show is my legacy Twitter, and I do a lot of tweeting. If you want to hear my shows, go to Deep Dives with Monica Perez on your favorite podcasting platform. You'll hear a few commercials. I do not even break even production-wise because I have to pay a producer. So I have like a little, and you might consider this, Hello Kitty.
I know.
It's oh my kitty. Schmoop. It's time to go. Kitty has arrived. So if you, there is a thing, and I don't know if you do this, but you, Apple iTunes will let people subscribe. Oh. And they can skip those canned commercials. Cause I think you also, that Spotify network, I love that. Like, it's a privilege to be able to put commercials in there because that is what helps me pay like that production cost. But if people don't like the commercials, you can just hit a button and have a subscription.
Oh, cool.
In Apple. You might want to do that. But anyway, and that I think pushes you up on the search because it makes Apple a little bit of money, makes Apple like a lot of money. So anyway,
gotcha.
So if you want to hear it commercial free, please subscribe. That would be how you support me. Is just if you listen on iTunes, just subscribe there.
And for those of you that have messaged me and said, I can't believe that you would run a McDonald's commercial or a Walmart or a Monsanto commercial at the beginning of your shows, I don't control those. Yeah. Okay.
You can turn off some categories.
I've turned off the categories that make sense to turn off.
Like
but
farmer,
sometimes.
Whatever, but they get around it. I stopped doing that too. Like I didn't turn like the ones I turned off, but there's only like 8 categories. Like you wouldn't have any left and they're paying for it. The joke's on that.
Oh, that's what I say too. I say, oh, I hope Pfizer advertises all over my show. It would be lighting money on fire.
Like, good for them. I felt bad because I think I heard once like a CNN commercial and I just started laughing like on the show. I was just like, can you believe it? And then I thought I should probably not outwardly insult them. However, no one is listening.
Nobody that's listening to this is going to listen to your CNN garbage or they're not going to go.
I thought they would cancel me. Like I was worried, like I really wouldn't be able to do the show if I didn't have commercials because I just don't have the organizational capacity to do sponsorships like you do. I used to do it and I just couldn't.
Yeah.
I got my kid is Down syndrome. Like I gotta follow around a 20-year-old. Like,
you got your hands full.
I can't mess around sitting down. If I can't move around, I can't do it. So I love the commercials, but if you don't, then you can subscribe on iTunes to Deep Dives with Monica Perez.
Awesome. You're the best. If you like this episode, you can take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can follow me on Twitter, where Monica and I point out interesting things when we're not arguing with robots, or you can go to the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you again soon.